The following lecture is a presentation of the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, FARMS, at Brigham Young University. It was given as part of a conference at BYU titled Temples Through the Ages on December 4th, 1999.
Brother Nibley is Emeritus Professor of Religion and Ancient History here at the university. His PhD is from the University of California at Berkeley. He's written extensively on the Book of Mormon, and particularly on the Book of Abraham. And I think if you were to select one other theme that has been the focus of his long years of scholarship and work, it would be on the temple. Farms and Deseret Book have to date published 13 volumes in the collected works of Hugh Nibley. You might be interested to know that there are 12 other volumes under consideration and under preparation in that collected works. That corpus of work itself, I think, is a testament to the amount of effort that he's put into his studies and his scholarship over the years. He's currently working on a manuscript entitled One Eternal Round, Facsimile 2 in the Pearl of Great Price. Professor Nibley.
Those who saw the recently TV documentary, Joseph Smith, American Prophet, may have noticed an interesting defect in the script, namely that it was Hamlet with Hamlet left out. And this is what Brother Ricks was talking about. We don't begin to know how to estimate Joseph Smith. Excuse me if I swig. Now, nothing like the bottle to give you comfort. Now, here we go. It was as if one were to produce a life of Shakespeare with charming views of Stratford-on-Avon, country school, the poaching story, marriage to Anne Hathaway, showbiz in London, respectable retirement, without bothering to mention that our leading character gave the world the greatest treasury of dramatic art in existence. Or a life of Bach, with his niggardly brother guardian, his early poverty, his odd jobs with vocal organs and choirs, his acceptance in the courts of the empire, his 19 children, and his loving nature, without a word about the greatest volume of music ever produced by a mortal. It's the same thing with Joseph Smith. They told us everything about him and told us nothing about him, as I think what Brother Ricks had just told us. No one has the slightest inkling of the mass and charge of his legacy to us. I sometimes think how it would be. I don't have Book of Mormon here. I sometimes think how it would be if I had to hand in a term paper, the subject of which was a thousand-year history of a nation, in detail, fiction, if you will, or anything else, but one semester to do it in. Panic as the day approaches. I've got to get that paper in. I have one more week. What will I do? What on earth will I write? What can I put in the book? He has to write this book, this kid. Everybody's talked about it, you know. The newspapers have been heckling, Morrisau Signal, the newspapers have been heckling and guffawing. Everybody was waiting for Joe to fall on his face. Surprise, surprise, he brought out the book. 500 pages of factual information. This is a tremendous book, you see. He brought, quite a book. This is, how long would it take you to produce this? Just free to do anything you want, put in anything you want. That could be fiction. You don't have to have anything real at all. But he produced this thing. Nobody ever considered, nothing like that has ever happened before or since. It's unbelievable. Well, certainly is. Nobody will believe it. Get some light here. So, what do you put into it? Anything you want to, but it had very good. He brought out the book, as I say, 500 pages, and on time, and invited the critics to do their worst. And, of course, everybody, including ourselves, has avoided the big question, how did he do it? This just gets me. Local mobs chased him down country roads and broke into his house at night, but nobody was able to explain where he got the book. In the same sense, does anyone alive have the vaguest clue as to what Joseph really gave us in the temple? That was the greatest of all. The Book of Abraham tells us a lot about it, but who reads the Book of Abraham? In a letter dated February the 26th, 1991, the director of the Berlin Egyptian Museum, in answer to an LDS student, responded, quote, The interpretations printed in the three facsimiles have nothing to do with Egyptian beliefs. They are pure fantasy. In the last sentence, however, the director obligingly refers his correspondent to Professor Eric Hornung, specifically in his book The Valley of the Kings, which he recommends as giving the real explanation of the Egyptian drawings. He says, you look at this book of Hornung's. Now, this is welcome advice, since Professor Hornung is probably the supernova of the so-called new school of Egyptology. He's the best man going today. So, obedient to the good director, we turn at once to Hornung's guidebook, which refers us to the works of yet another giant. He writes, Egyptian historiography reaches its high water mark with Edward Meyer. With all haste we repair to the books of Meyer, who bids us all students of ancient religion to seek wisdom in the works of giant number 4. Now we're quoting Meyer, going down the line here. He says, Mormonism is one of the most instructive phenomena in the whole area of religious history. That was especially ancient religion, the great Edward Meyer, you know, the last great scholar, so, of religious history. And it is most remarkable that the students of religion who have sought enlightenment in the most remote, inaccessible, and all but incomprehensible religions of the past have kept themselves strictly aloof from Mormonism and disdained the rich instruction it has to offer. This singularity meant nothing to anyone, he assures us. It is the case of Joseph Smith that sheds light upon all the others and helps us to reach an understanding of the fundamental problems. Now, that's a great recommendation for Meyer, but what about Meyer himself? This is my point. Though the great Edward Meyer was impressed enough to come to Utah in 1904 and carry on his investigations here, he never bothered to read the Book of Mormon. He wouldn't look at it. Now, what have you got there? This is the main testimony of the man. Meyer wouldn't look at it. See, we're all avoiding something here, aren't we? That only a Mormon, he says, only a Mormon could have the patience to get it through it. And for him, the Pearl of Great Price just doesn't exist. And yet, this is a special field for that very reason. He could not lower himself to take it seriously. Joseph Smith's resurrection of the temple should have electrified him, but in those days it was fashionable in Egyptologists to hold all religion, and especially that of crazy, irrational Egyptians, in contempt. They did it very recently, you know, all my teachers did, and so forth. Another swing? Gosh. This is the Irish in me coming out. I won't be able to leave alone. Well, it's another picture today. The so-called new school of Egyptology. Gotta get some light here. New school of Egyptology has focused and held its full attention on the religion of Egypt. Almost every leading scholar has written a work of all things on the Egyptian concept of the other world, the hereafter, which requires deep searching into temple and funerary literature. And they recognize essentially the same. The funeral literature of the Egyptians is temple literature. It began, the pyramid texts, for example, or both. Why? They both have the same person, to get you over into the other world. The funeral and the temple literature. The temple is just where you make contact with the other world. So, the ancient world was filled with temples. You know that, we said it before. But it really was. 2 centuries of worldwide comparative studies have come up with the conclusion that there existed throughout the world from the most ancient times a body of religious beliefs and practices centered around the temple. Everyone recognized the sameness of the dominant theme and allows for local variation, but there's one cult of the temple throughout the entire world. Very strange. But it's generally agreed that we have bold common concepts prevailing from prehistoric times right down to Christianity, virtually unchanged. There's a general agreement today, strange as it seems, it's come recently, that the temple rites and the funeral rites all had the common intent, namely, to see the subject safely through this world and secure in the next as a resurrected and exalted being. Resurrection and eternal life were the engrossing concern of religion from the beginning. Everybody thinks that now. To make such a transition, the temple was necessary, being defined, just the way you usually find, as the a place of contact. Horan calls it the interface, a place where this world and that world meet. It's always been that, where the two worlds come together. And between the worlds above and below the earth. More recently, emphasis has been put on the function relating to the cosmos. It relates to the cosmos. It's where we take off. Well, Horning doesn't hesitate to use the figure of space travel. He says the mummy case is really a module for traveling through space to reach other worlds. They go into all that sort of thing now. This was the only solution to the one great problem that has ever haunted the human race. One great problem, the problem of facing death. And we have suddenly come to acknowledge that the one problem that all of us are and ever have been concerned with is that question, first of all. I'm going to address, going to be very civilized now. The Neo-Freudians, there's a very good book, a recent one by Becker on this subject, it won a very important prize. The Neo-Freudians have finally recognized that the rediscovery of modern psychology, we're quoting here, that death is man's peculiar and greatest anxiety, outranking even sex. In his prize-winning book, Ernest Becker finds, he says, that all historic religions addressed themselves to this same problem of how to bear the end of life. Religions like Hinduism and Buddhism performed the ingenious trick of pretending not to want to be reborn, he says. Not so are Egyptians. Morantz has pointed out the complete contrast between what he calls the eternity of the Egyptian individual and the transmigration of the Indians. The one is determined to be himself forever, as Brigham Young says, and the other is resigned to becoming anything you please. A drop of water in an ocean of being is preferable. Well, if modern scholars are depressed by the mortuary atmosphere of Egyptian culture, our modern world has even more demoralizing message. The absolute scientific certainty that man goes back into the ground a few feet in order blindly and dumbly to rot and disappear forever, taking with him his vast unrealized potential. No wonder, he says, he's quoting Pascal here, the full apprehension of man's condition would drive him insane. That one there is, you think of 2 Nephi 7 and 9, he says, if the course of nature is followed, we must go down into the earth to rot and decay and rise no more. See? But something must be working against that, the very thing that he uses, you see. And you find lots of charms in Egyptian in all the literature against Pharaoh will not rot, he will not decay, he will not putrefy. They talk a lot about the stink and the rot and the dust and the smell and everything. And it's very unpleasant, but they've got to face it, they say. And Eliade concludes his work on the cosmos and history with a warning that unless we find a new formula for man's collaboration with creation to give tragedy a meaning, we must be prey to continual terror. We're approaching the new millennium, and lots of people are scared stiff. You see, this is what he's talking about. And the temple provides the formula. Since death cannot be denied, it can't, you know, it really happens, what hope is there for the hereafter? The Egyptian answer, as everybody is recognizing today, and everybody says this and repeats it, was to start all over again and have a new life. That meant new creation. Well, how is that to be affected? There is one glowing example which no one can overlook, and that's the sun. The Egyptians, all the other people too, the Egyptians, like other ancient people, made the most of it. Stick close to the sun was the idea, and do what he does. Get yourself a place in his boat as a crew member, attendant, sign on as an assistant, or a chemisrei, a member of the family, or one of his religious followers. To prolong your old life, you must get in on the action. You must be present at the only time and place that the sun completed his one cycle. And of course, that was the solstice, the winter solstice, when the sun reaches the bottom and for an unspeakable brief second and then starts going up again. That's when you jump onto the boat. The Romans had a very interesting name for that. Well, anyway, the sun completing one cycle and reaching the other, the lowest point, without a split second hesitation reverses its direction and starts the upward climb. That's when you must join in. So you must be there at that particular place, that moment of creation, when the sun begins his new life. This means that everybody in the world has to come together at a special place, the exact center of the cosmos, since the point of convergence for the pilgrims from roads from every direction, the only place they can commonly meet was be in the center of everything. That figured out. And for the beginning of a new life cycle, you must start the creation all over again, and that's the creation drama we talked about that you see in the temple and Abraham has given us. As far as we can trace the records of the ruins, there have been great gatherings of the race. The panegyrist means everybody gathered in a circle. In every part of the world, many have recognized the phenomenon, but no one can explain how or when it began. Edward Meyer thinks it started with the animals in their periodic meetings to disport and reproduce. They come together and have groups. You see in various documentaries, they do that. Wolves, and Vera and I got into a herd of elk, having a great celebration. Trumpeting and everything else, they were quite wild. But no, they come together regularly to reproduce and get the world going again. So Edward Meyer said, animals do, why don't we? Megalithic circles, these great stone circles marking the ceremonial assemblages, are found by the thousands and go back to the Stone Age. Over 10,000 of them have been counted. I had the good fortune to be stationed at Avebury in Herefordshire. That's the greatest and one of the oldest, and largest, one of the oldest of the centers in the world. At the end of the late war, and had ample time to examine the vast establishment. That was before it was discovered for the tourists. The stone circle, 1,400 feet in diameter, is a huge thing. A great artificial mound is there called Silbury Hill, the highest artificial mound in Europe. To beckon the pilgrim from afar, it took 35 million baskets of earth to build that Silbury Hill. You can see it from miles away. That from a community that's calculated of only 500 souls, how long would it take to dump 35 million baskets to build that artifact? It's the mountain of the Logberg. It's the mountain of the Lord's house, the mountain of the law. See, the temple is on the mountain of the law. There always has to be a mountain from which you recognize the place that you're going to. That's a big subject in itself, you see. The mountain dominated the flat surrounding plain. This flat, and it's littered with bones still of lunching and fasting. The people came there and feasted, and they camped there. That was where the camping, that was the great camping place. Remember the camps in all these places? Thou shalt not celebrate the Passover within thy gates, which the Lord thy God gives thee. You must make the trip. And if you go, you have to camp out there. You get this in the Book of Mormon, you see, at Mosiah's coronation. Then you have to live in tents, so it becomes a festival of the booths everywhere. The word booth, our word booth, is the same as the word Hebrew and Arabic. Bait is a house. Bait, booth, our word bait means to stay the night over. And it's international, you find it everywhere. The booth, abide with me, tis eventide. Where do you abide? You abide in the booth. And the booth is the bait, which is the house. And the temple is called the bait. That's the house of God. That's the bait. So this is out in a wild place because, as we're told, they needed shelter from the elements while they were camping out there. We get the same picture in the Book of Mormon very vividly. Joseph Smith knew all the answers on that one. Well, from the air, I had to pass over this place slowly, quote, in regular and frequent glider flights, and I could behold the traces of prehistoric roads marked by standing stones leading from all directions. That's the general layout of countless ceremonial centers. As I say, there are over 10,000 of them have been registered. According to Aubrey Burrell, the principal authority, it is strangely parallel in North America, where the collapsed trading networks of the Hopewell were followed by the Temple Mound societies. According to the British Circle, according to him, the British circles were separated from Cahokia, that's in North America, by 3,000 years and 4,000 miles, the Atlantic Ocean. But the Cahokia culture definitely goes back to Teotihuacan, and nobody doubts, well, somebody might doubt, but they look so much alike, they're peas in a pod, it's astonishing. Strangely, I was prepared for this surprise earlier in Berkeley. 8 years earlier in Berkeley, I had produced a long, laborious comparative study, a thesis examining eyewitness accounts of some 15 such holy centers, scattered widely throughout the old world. There were 15 cusps. What went on in the same places? The same things happened. Within a year of returning from the army, I went straight to Provo, where I met Brother Virgil Bushman, a great missionary to the Hopi and Navajos, who urged me to come with him and see something of the ancient world in Arizona. I have described our arrival in Hota Villa in a piece called Promised Lands, and this is the way it was put. I was stunned what I saw as we came through a low arch at dawn. It was a cold March morning, the first dance year, and there was nobody there, just a few little kids washing, some old people hunched in blankets around the top. But this place was nobody, and this magnificent theater was going on. Here we are on a high rock with nothing but desolation in all parts. Remember, these are the Hopi mesas. Nothing but desolation in all directions you could look on. And out in this cold nothing, as if it was suspended in space, I see a full-scale drama in procession. Well, it was like a revelation. What's going on? It was a terrific show. And he said, a splendid drama in progress here on the high bleak rock surrounded by nothing that you would call total desolation in all directions, the full-scale drama in progress in the grand manner of the ancients. Everything is being carried out with meticulous care. All the costumes were fresh and new, blowing in the wind. Nothing artificial. All the dyes, all the woven stuff, all the properties, nothing could be gotten in a store. Everything had to be from nature. What an immense effort and dedication that these people had. And for what? They were the only people in the world that still took the trouble to do what the human race had been doing for many millennia, celebrating the great life cycle of the year, the creation, the dispensations. I told Brother Bushman, when the dancers started coming out, there should be 52 dancers, and there were 52. That's the sacred number of the Aztecs, sacred number of the Mongols. It's the sacred number of Israel. Remember Israel, they had the 52 shevet, the 52 staves of the tribes in the Ark of the Covenant, were 52 seals, each representing a tribe of Israel, the same 52. You get these same customs everywhere, and it's quite astonishing, to say the least. Well, then, all celebrating at the same time of the year, and all celebrating the same way, all these other people. This was at Hota Villa, which today is exciting new study. It's been revived now. That it was just about dead when I visited by a special invitation a couple of years ago. I stayed with the chiefs and so forth, and they'd given up. They weren't going to plant anymore or do anything more. But now there is a revival in this book of Thomas Mayles. He's written a large book on this, but quite a useful one, called Hota Villa, The Hopi Shrine of the Covenant, the Microcosm of the World. And they think that Hota Villa is that. They're quite serious about it. Well, I have taken some beautiful, through the years, I have taken some beautiful, I've gone through over 50 years, I've been going to visit them, very well known. The first generation was gone. I've taken some beautiful reproductions of Egyptian papyri to show to the children and to the elders in Hota Villa, and they have been greatly impressed by the resemblances to their own rituals that the dancers always have to have in both the cultures, in both the Egyptian and the Hopi. The two feathers in the head, the copper bracelets on the arms, the fox tail behind, it must be there, the fox or coyote tail behind, the bandolier over the shoulder, and you have to have. The face paint is very important. The oldest records we have are the palettes used for mixing the paint to paint the faces of the dancers. And so the same cult's going on everywhere. It's the most marvelous thing. And when I've taken professors from Israel to visit the Hopis, they were simply bowled over. What's his name, Professor Shinar, who teaches Hebrew at Hebrew University, who teaches Arabic at Hebrew University. I paid us a visit, and I took him down there with the Rafi brothers, who were Israelis. And he saw, well, he saw a woman was making something, was reading something. He said, "What's that?" And I said, "That's a shawl, a prayer shawl." He said, "Well, we have the same pattern." I said, "What do they call it?" I said, "It was a sheesh." He nearly fainted. He says, "That's what we call it." And Rafi, the little boys were beating some drums on a mound. And Rafi stopped and said, "Now, wait a minute. Listen to that song." And he joined in and sang with them. He says, "That's a song. We used to sing that in my village." Now, how permanent is this stuff? It gives you the creeps. No, but this has been checked on many times. See, this was, well, we talk about this just briefly here, but we'll get around to this. This recognition of a prehistoric worldwide order of things, religious and political, picked up speed with the founding of the East India Company, 1773. Eager young Englishmen discovering the East and the primacy of the Sanskrit language. They broke out into the open field with, quote, inquiry into all languages to reduce them to one common center from which they spread into arc rays of the sun. They decided that it was just one common language, one common culture. And this was decided way back there, you see, and that it was Sanskrit and India. Now, the progress of science is marked by the writings of the great Max Müller. First of all, 1849 to 73, he translated his monumental Rig Veda Samavita. And then he wrote a broader work next called The Origin and Growth of Religion, 1879. And finally, he ends up with a wide-ranging science of mythology and finally to the next step. He says, if the heathens already possessed an abundant stock of religious myths, then song and story could not fail to interweave themselves with the rites and customs. Throughout the world, students started studying these various major events, especially this yearly event, this New Year rite, the great celebration, the year rite, and started making lists of what they went on. Everybody had his lists, and then they started comparing these lists, and they were compared practically the same. Usually the same five main things were the same. They displayed surprising agreement and conformity, especially in the five events, Lord Reagan says. Eliada strings together, the place, the celestial prototype, the art, the act of creation, the creation of the world, the sacred marriage, Adam and Eve, the confrontation with evil, Satan, the victory of the king, the coronation. To these, he adds the atoning sacrifice, cleansing the people of their sins, the memories of paradise, festivities wistfully but happily recalling the golden age. As we summed up the picture many years ago, at hundreds of holy shrines, see, I collected records of dozens of them. I wrote up 15 of them, but I got over 50. As we summed up pictures many years ago, at hundreds of holy shrines, each believed to mark the exact center of the universe, representing as the point at which the four corners of the earth converged, the navel of the earth, they called it, Omphalos, one might have seen assembled at the new year the moment of the creation, the beginning of time, vast concourses of people, each thought to represent the entire human race in the presence of all the ancestors and gods. The whole trend can be summed up in an astonishing statement quite recently made by Eliade just before he died. I knew him at Chicago. And here. This is what he wrote. It's almost unbelievable for a responsible scientist to say this. In extremely diverse cultural contexts, we always find the same cosmological pattern and the same ritual scenario. As man progressively occupies increasingly vast areas of the planet, they seem to do is repeat indefinitely the same archetypal gesture. They're going through the same thing wherever you are. That's a very sweeping statement to make. The great object of the Egyptian ritual was, and I quote here, from Westendorf, a very good Egyptologist, the creation, maintenance, and continuation of life beyond death in the cosmos as well as on Earth. After creation, the vital forces of all creatures had to be preserved for eternity, this being accomplished by a continuous renewal or rejuvenation, and for this they have the temple. It is a case of, as Horung says, of periodically recharging the sun. This requires the aid of all living things. Mankind must cooperate in the, dare say, the best French scholar on this subject, the rites and ordinances that express the unity of the universe, which must be repeated to keep up man's awareness of them, without which the whole structure would vanish. We must participate. If you're going to live forever, you're better. And Alexander Sharp says, everything meaningful is brought together in a single meaningful whole. Everything has to be brought together at this particular time, at this particular place, and then a new age can begin. It was both Natalia and the great birthday and resurrection when everybody went wild with good news that the death had been overcome and the hero had risen. And I quote a number of early Christian writers here who report what they saw in Egypt, but then showing that there was the resurrection. Not the least significant note on the importance of the temple is that it is the source and origin of civilization. Everything comes from it, you notice. Consider the spin-offs of this great year, right, generated throughout the world. It goes back, as they say, to prehistoric times. In fact, Paleolithic. The bringing together of vast numbers of peasants from widely scattered regions, bringing their offerings to the temple, required in exchange for converting their substance to acceptable offerings. Hence, you have banks. The bank means the bench of the exchange artist, of the money changers in the courts of the temple, in the outer court of the temple. You'd exchange what you brought locally, so it could be acceptable here, just as you have to exchange when you go to another country, you change your money. So the banks started out with the temples. We know that well. Our word money, juno moneta, in Rome, the first, when you came to the capital, the first place you had to stop and declare yourself was on the capital, juno moneta. Moneta meaning she protected the city. It was on watch to see that nothing funny went on. So you went up there and you declared yourself, and that was the money. And the place where you would change it was on the benches. They had the bench. They still have them there, you see, on the wharf, say, at the Piraeus. They have their black velvet little stand set out with the money, coins on them, you make the exchange. That's a bench, that's a bank. That's our word bank, you see. And our temples are still banks, you see, the marble and the bronze and the sanctimonious hush, and above all, the inner sanctum. When you go down to, which is the vault, of course, that's the Holy of Holies. That's this, just taking it over, completely substitute, you see. It's an interesting thing. Well, the exchange of goods and services was the great opportunity of the year. It was one time and place at which servants could be hired out for a year and a day, was the formula. For long, dangerous journeys, you had to have the pilgrims coming. You had to have hostels, and hospitals had to be provided. The local youth inevitably engaged in demonstrations of local pride and prowess, songs, dances, races, athletic events, dramatic recitations, competitions, plays by traveling troops, clowns. The best time to sell your stuff is at the yarmark, at the yearly market, when everybody comes together. This is where all civilization is centered. There's a good deal of whole German school about that sort of thing. Homer has given us the whole picture in the hymn to Apollo. He says the gods look down and see man suffering below there, and it's a terrible time. We used to be together, now they're down there, and they're awful, because he says they're poor, helpless creatures, they're stupid, they're our mechanists, they don't know how to take care of themselves. And he says, above all, they don't have an akos, they don't have a cure for death or old age. So what are we going to do? Well, he said, let's meet with them from time to time, he says. So Leto, the mother of of Apollo, decides to send her son down and establish these meeting places where every year people would come, and he describes how they come together. We'll meet with them, and for a time we'll feast together, and they'll have a golden age and feel very happy about it. And we'll distribute them throughout the whole world. And the pilgrims will come from all directions. When they get there, they'll be all changed. They change their dusty clothes to white robes. They'll wash themselves off, and they'll anoint themselves to engage in rites and so forth. It'll be very nice. And for a time we'll have a visit with them, and they'll know that we belong to them. Well, this is the idea of the temple. You get it everywhere, you see.
You may turn the tape over now to continue the program.